We finished up B then, which was England in the first half of the century, did we? And we noticed there I made a slip of the mind. I got shrewd and favor mixed in my mind there. I don't know how I did it because they were very different men. Shrewd died comparatively young. Favor lived much longer. Shrewd died in the Episcopal Church, though he was a very high churchman, was very strong on ceremonies. Favor became a Roman priest. But Favor is the one who wrote the great number of poems, some of them very beautiful hymns, and some of them with a comparatively little change here and there, very few points, can express the sentiments that all of us would feel. He came in contact with the liberalism and denial of parts of the broad church, and he was greatly impressed with the high church leaders, and eventually he went into the Church of Rome. But he wrote some very beautiful hymns, and this one, the Faith of Our Fathers, has two or three lines about the adoration of Mary and so on, but simply changing those two or three lines or leaving out that paragraph, because most hymns in those days had many stanzas in them, it becomes a hymn that can mean a great deal to all of us and can express our aspirations and desires just as clearly as it did his. But then we went on looking at Unitarianism in New England. What was number one under that? What? Didn't I give a number one? Yes, but I didn't give numbers then. I see. Well, maybe we ought to make some numbers for it then. Unitarianism in New England. Let's call number one the parish system. Parish system, P-R-I-S-H, the parish system. Now, this was the result of the settlement of New England by the settlement of New England by people who had come to New England not looking for freedom of religion, not looking for toleration, not looking for a situation where in the midst of people who disagreed with them, they could nevertheless be permitted to continue in what they believed in. People came to New England who wanted to have an opportunity to develop a society in accordance with the Bible as they understood. And that was true of the Pilgrims. They, in their first 20 years, they sent back to England several people who had come, giving the impression they agreed with them, but who proved to be out of sympathy with them. They shipped them back to England. And the great number of Puritans who followed. They were looking for a place where they could raise their children under thoroughly Christian auspices and without having constantly to fight against the opposition of different types of ideas. But the result was that religion was established in most of New England up, I believe, till about 1835 or 36. To say that the First Amendment to the Constitution means that no state can have an establishment of religion is not interpreting the Constitution, but twisting it. Because certainly that was not the idea of the founders of the Constitution. Massachusetts continued to have an established church for at least 50 years after that time. And in Virginia, through Thomas Jefferson's efforts, the Episcopal Church had been disestablished just about the time of the Revolutionary War. I believe it was between that and the making of the Constitution. But there were a number of states that had establishment of religion during those periods. Now, we feel that that is unwise, and I think the way it worked out in New England proved that it was. Because while on the one hand it meant that they could carry on without having interference from a state that was contrary to them, on the other hand, it meant that they had to either insist that nobody have a vote in the state who was not a converted Christian, or else make some arrangement for people. And so they made arrangements when there came to be people in these states of New England that did not believe. They said, well, they can be part of the parish. As part of the parish, they are, in a sense, members of the church. They have a right to vote on matters of importance, but then those who were converted, they formed the church within the parish. But the parish controls the property, and the parish controlled the church. Well, it was through this arrangement, here you see you have a situation quite similar, though different, but similar in general principle to what we saw in Scotland, where the patronage system interfered with the freedom of the church. Here it was the establishment system which resulted in the parish having control over the church, even though there were many people in the parish as years went on who weren't really interested much in the church, but they had control over the church. And so early in the 19th century, there came to be modernist teaching came into Harvard University, and young men began to go out from there who were affected by modernism. They might even be considered rather conservative today, but they denied certain of the essential deities, at least in a theoretical way. That is, they would not say that Jesus Christ was equal with God. There's one God. But many of them would say Jesus is the Savior. Apart from him, there's no hope for us. His death on the cross saves us. It seems quite inconsistent to us. But many of these men were very conservative in their terminology, many of these preachers. They would have a great conservative central belief, but then they would give up various doctrines which logically would undermine these central ones. And then ministers in New England who were very strongly evangelical did not like to have these other ministers come in and preach in their pulpits. And so the situation of A.B.L. Holmes is a very good example of what happened, though he's only one of many. I'll call that number two, A.B.L. Holmes. I mentioned to you last time that A.B.L. Holmes had been for 38 years, I believe, pastor of the First Parish Church of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there he was a very strong Calvinist. He was a very ardent evangelical. He had a large group of members of the church who were very devoted to him. But in the parish there were many who preferred to have the teaching of the men of Unitarian attitudes. And so when they began to say, why can't you exchange pulpits with some of these men? Well, A.B.L. said, I don't want any of them in my pulpit. And then when A.B.L. had his vacation, they tried to bring in these men. And when he objected strongly, and so did the members of the church, the parish simply voted that A.B.L. Holmes was dismissed from being pastor of the church. And he being dismissed, and the people, the church members almost unanimously wanting him, they stepped out and started a new church in the neighborhood. And when they stepped out, the others not only took, that is, the parish not only took the property, but they sued them to get the funds that were in the bank account, the hymn books, the communion set, every bit of property of the church they sued for in the courts and took away from them. So that they had absolutely nothing. They had to start from scratch in the neighborhood, which they did. And A.B.L. Holmes, I mentioned to you, had a son, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who, according to Mrs. Bowen, in her book called Yankee from Olympus, which is an account of the life of Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Justice of the Supreme Court, she starts with his grandfather. She tells about A.B.L. and about his dismissal from the church there, and then she says that Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote his books, The Autocrat of the Breakfast Table, The Poet of the Breakfast Table, The Professor of the Breakfast Table, so on, in order to try to cure himself of Calvinism. But that Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. had no trouble with it. He was already thoroughly cured from it. And so there you have the progress, or progression or regression, whatever you want to call it, the succession, you might say, that takes place so regularly. You have a man who is devoted to a man or a generation that is devoted to the Word of God and stands for the great teaching of the Word of God. And some people say, why don't they show more love? Why don't they put more emphasis on ethics and on social work? Well, actually, all the great advances in these lines have come directly or indirectly from the activity of fundamentalists, But to the world as a whole, the character of the man who is devoted to the Word of God often seems a bit harsh and a bit unbending. But then you get the next generation or the next step, and you get a man who is giving up the center of his faith, but who has inherited from his upbringing a great love for sound ethics, a great concept of duty, a love of all humanity, a desire to help them. And your first generation away from evangelical Christianity often impresses the world as being men of the most outstanding character. They're very attractive people, but they have inherited the center of their life, and they have putting their stress in areas which are more attractive to the world as a whole. But in most cases, you find that the third generation, the next step, gives up the character, gives up the ethics, and they either may go into spiritism or into astrology or some sort of fantastic business, or simply into a licentious sort of life. You have the downgrade, which thus I've seen the progression over and over in case after case. But in New England, as the Unitarian movement came in, you got a flowering of thought and of emphasis on ethics and on the byproducts of Christianity, which makes it seem as if in the early 19th century you had a very great outstanding group of wonderful men there in New England, men who had great influence for social improvement in various ways, men of very high character, but men who were stepping away from their loyalty to the Scripture. Now, they say they hadn't stepped nearly as far away, some of them, as most of the Unitarians or the modernists of today have. Well, some of them had stepped rather far. Others had only stepped comparatively little, but enough that they wanted to oppose inerrancy of the Scripture. They wanted to oppose the full deity of Christ, and people came to call them Unitarians, at first simply a name that was attributed to them. Now, A.B.L. Holmes is only one instance of many churches like this. And at the end, number three, we'll call New England Unitarianism. I'm thinking here of it as a denomination. They took over the churches in the greater part of New England, particularly around Boston. They took all the churches but two in Boston. The Unitarians took over. Yes? I would think so, yes, because Timothy Dwight was very active in Yale at this time. He was very strongly evangelical. So my impression would be most of them came from Harvard, which is entirely controlled by the Unitarians already at this time. Took over most of the churches, all the wealthy churches. They took over most of the endowments of the churches, most of the properties. They took over Harvard University. Yale University, with Timothy Dwight, was president, and it was strongly against this Unitarian movement. But they took the greatest of the two universities, and most of the wealth. People said, give us another 50 years. And these remaining churches, these Trinitarian churches, which came to call themselves congregational churches, they will disappear altogether, and the Unitarian will be the great church of the country. Well, I mentioned last time how I heard Dean Brown of Yale speaking 50 years ago, telling about this and saying that the congregational church was one of the slowest growing of major American denominations. And yet, he said, 100 years after this division, the congregational church was more than 10 times as large as the Unitarian Church. The Unitarian Church, in the course of time, pretty well dried up as far as being a large or a large group was concerned. They did not reach out or expand much. Many of their people drifted away, lost interest in it altogether. But their ideas were disseminated into all the other denominations to a very great extent in succeeding years. Now, number five, I want to mention, number four. Three we called New England Unitarianism. Number four, founding of Andover Seminary. Founding of Andover Seminary. The few people in the neighborhood of Boston, there were more perhaps in some of the outlying districts, but the few people who stood against this Unitarian movement and who continued then as congregational churches, they were anxious to have a place where their men could be trained, because most of the ministers were being trained in Harvard, and the Unitarians had complete control of the theological training in Harvard now. And they found an academy at Andover, Massachusetts, which had been formed on the same basis as Harvard, as a school to train people to be Christian leaders, but which had been mostly an academy. It had not, it had, its charter permitted it to train ministers, but the ministers had mostly been trained at Harvard up to this time. And so the Trinitarians began to raise money and support for Andover, and they developed it into a seminary. It's pretty hard to say when Andover Seminary began, because it was an institution in existence sometime before this, but not really a seminary. It was more of an academy, but they developed it into a seminary. And Andover, as a theological seminary, soon began to get money. People were contributing to it, students were coming to it, and about 1860, a man who was anxious to get a seminary started in Chicago told about his visit to an alumni meeting at Andover. And he said, in Andover, I saw over 1,000 men gathered together who were graduates of that seminary, who were active ministers and leaders in many parts of the United States, and many of whom were missionaries in various parts of the world. He said, it simply is tremendous, the influence that Andover Seminary has exerted. And so they developed a tremendous institution there at Andover Seminary. And it continued to be such for about 70 years. Now, this is getting us into the next half of the century. But I just mentioned that eventually the Unitarians or Unitarian-minded people got control of Andover Seminary. I got their people of their mind into the professorship. Then the student body began to fall off. And eventually the board said that since the student body had become so small, there was no longer any need of Andover, and so they united it with Harvard. And Harvard took its endowments and built their theological building, which they call Andover Hall, after Andover. And they took their library and united it with that of Harvard. Then about 1926, some laymen brought suit against this money being in the hands of Harvard University. And they pointed out that Andover had been built up in order to fight against the theology of Harvard, and therefore that it was a complete betrayal of trust to give over their money, their library, and everything to Harvard University. And they won the suit. But the court then said the money cannot go to Harvard, so they took it away from them and gave it to a Baptist seminary in Boston, named Newton Theological Seminary, which changed its name to Andover Newton, and which is practically as modernistic as Harvard. And so none of the money was actually preserved, it just was kept from being in the hands of Harvard as a result of that. Of course, that's getting 100 years after this present time. We're now looking at the first half of the century, and we're noticing that though Unitarianism was a tremendous blight there on the churches of New England, that the Andover, for a long period, was a very great and influential organization. Now, I knew a woman who was brought up in New England, who was in Boston and in Hartford early in this century, in congregational churches there, which were very evangelical at that time. And then 20 years later, she saw her old pastor, whom she had so admired for his great stand for the faith and his great love of winning souls for Christ. She moved away to another state. He visited there. 20 years later, And he talked about, we used to believe in this old gospel of the shambles. And he had completely gone modernistic, as most of the Congregational Church has now. But it had a period of about 100 years in which it was a very active and influential organization, and in which it accomplished a tremendous amount in reaching people for the Lord and building sound churches in this country, and also doing a great missionary work in nearly every part of the world. The Unitarian Church took as its stand the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the leadership of Jesus. And some people said, the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus, and the neighborhood of Boston. And it was in its start quite they were intellectually very proud of thinking of themselves as superior in their understanding, and they took over Harvard and these great churches in New England. And eventually New England became almost a desert, where it's one of the hardest parts of the country religiously to find a sound church. There are a few outstanding lights there, but the whole atmosphere in general is greatly changed from the situation of even 100 years ago. Well, now so much then for the rise of Unitarianism. That was C. Now D will be a subject that we would not take your time to discuss at this point, except that it is an introduction to important events later on. And so I will call D here literary criticism. Literary criticism. And under that head, I will look at certain attitudes of the first half of the last century, attitudes which began to some extent before that, but which affected only a very, very small part of the population at that time. They did affect the Unitarian Church leadership, for instance, but they did not affect any great part of the population in the first half of last century. But eventually they had tremendous results. So it's important we know about them, and rather than wait till later and come back, I'm going to point out these type of developments now. It began in Germany with the rise of a very skeptical school of history and literature. This school was largely, we're using school in the general sense, of group of people. The great leader in it was a man named Wolff, W-O-L-F, F-A Wolff. And Professor Wolff was just short, he lived before and after 1800. He was a very able lecturer, a very great student. Some think of him as the founder of the science of philology. And Wolff took the attitude that we will not accept any ancient document as true unless we find absolute proof of it from other sources. It was an ultra-skeptical attitude which he took toward antique writings. And he raised the question then about these writings, how did they get into their present shape? And so he and others began making up theories to account for ancient writings, for their coming into their present condition. Now this was purely a literary movement, literary and historical, but primarily literary. And Wolff spent a great deal of time studying Homer. He wrote what he called the Prolegomena to Homer, which had a tremendous influence. And he said, actually, there was no such man as Homer, and the Homeric writings are an aggregation of writings by various men. And he tried to divide out from it a certain book and another book and show how these two or three main books were fitted together, and then little sections written by other people. And once he gave the great poet Goethe in Germany was thought so much of Wolff's great abilities that once he came to the place where Wolff lectured and got Wolff's daughter to let him hide behind the curtain so as not to upset Wolff by seeing him there and leave him perfectly at ease, he hid behind the curtain to listen to his lecture on Homer. And Goethe thought this was a tremendous advice. But then Goethe went back to reading Homer and studying it, and he wrote toward the end of his life, a writing in which he completely gave up these ideas. He said no one but a tremendous genius could write such works as the works of Homer. He said there must be almost entirely a unified work, because it would be impossible to take a lot of separate writers and to get something of such transcendent genius as this writer. But Goethe's influence in advancing this was far more effective than his influence against it at the end of his life, when he recanted the idea and turned against it. And this approach came to be directed by a group of literary students, which was had comparatively little influence for many years on the world outside of literary studies. But among these literary students, they began to try to study every sort of work in this line. They took the Nibelungenlied, the great German epic, divided up among several different authors and showed where its different sources came from. The English Beowulf, they did the same thing with. They did it with most of these works of ancient times. And they naturally did the same thing in relation to the Bible. And so they suggested that Moses had not written the book of Genesis. Well, how could Moses have written Genesis anyway? He wasn't even living when these things in Genesis occurred. So they said Genesis, it is in 1753, a French writer said he thought we could divide Genesis up into its sources. So in 1753, Astruc, a French writer, A-S-T-R-U-C, Astruc wrote on attempt to reconstruct the documents that Moses used in writing Genesis. He didn't deny, Astruc, that Moses wrote Genesis. But he said he must have used documents, because he didn't see the things actually happen. And we can separate out these documents. And Astruc wrote a writing on it, which most of the German scholars laughed at if they even referred to it. Astruc got very little attention. But about 1800, a German writer wrote an introduction to the Old Testament, a man named Eichhorn, E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N. E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N, a very brilliant German writer, wrote an introduction to the Old Testament. And in it, he advanced substantially the same theory that Astruc had advanced. And Eichhorn said in introducing it, he said, we must study Genesis like we would any other literary work. And he said to any student of literary matters, the term higher criticism will be perfectly clear. We are looking at the higher criticism of Genesis. And what he meant was that literary students at that time considered lower criticism to be the study of a book to try to determine its correct text and to understand the meaning of the individual words and allusions and so on in it. That is lower criticism. While higher criticism dealt with the question, is it one work or is it composed of different sources? Who is the author? What is the time of its writing and so on? Didn't mean the higher was any better or greater than lower, but a different area, which they called higher criticism. And even today you will find books written presenting divisive theories of the Bible, which say we must look at the Bible with the same approach as you would to any other literary work. But the interesting thing is that this literary approach, which was so common then and applied to all writings then, has today been given up, except in relation to the Bible. It is still very much used in relation to the Bible, but otherwise it is given up. So it is investigating the Bible in a method that is not in line with present literary study, but in line with that of 150 years ago. So it was a tendency which continued very strongly up until well into the present century, but today is just about completely abandoned by literary scholars. I was interested a couple of years ago to look up the leading handbooks on literary criticism and literary history. I got about 20 of them, the University of Pennsylvania Library. And in every one, I looked up higher criticism in the index. And I found that they either had no reference whatever to higher Christianity, no use of the word, or if they had any reference at all, it was referring to the Bible. And so it just shows how completely it has changed from Eichhorn's situation, where he said any literary student knows what's meant by higher Christianity, we will apply it to the Bible. You had a question, Mr. Lipton?
I was just going to say that I read in Time Magazine a very good copy of this small section there.
Time is catching up to the literary curses of 150 years ago. Yes.
They use a computer to use the higher criticism method and came to the conclusion that Isaiah had to be written by more than one author and there was only a 100,000 one chance to be written by one person.
Yeah. Which, of course, is utter nonsense. But it is expressed so dogmatically in Time with a headline and the statements. It is now proven by computers. You say, 150 years ago, some people questioned whether Isaiah was one book or two. Now it has been proven by modern technology that it is two works. It, of course, is utter nonsense. And it is utterly out of line with literary studies in every other field except the Bible. Mr. Trindle, do you?
Did anybody try to check their methods against known writers? The common scientific techniques have methods you want to check against
them. No,
did they do
it? No, they don't. They just dogmatically state it. Yeah, I think if you would, they say that if you take Isaiah 1, says in Time, 1 to 39, you find that 8 5/10% of the words have some relation to some idea connected with war. But that in 40 to 66, only 5.6 or something percent have relation to something related to war. Well, now, if you would take Sinclair Lewis's book, Aerosmith, you would probably find that 8% or maybe 10% of the words have some relation to something to do with medicine. And if you took his book, Main Street, you would probably find not over 1% had anything to do with medicine. It is a matter, that sort of thing only shows a difference of subject matter, and there is certainly a difference in subject matter between Isaiah 1 to 39 and 40 to 66. But it is a method which is today practically discarded. Now, as early as about 1905, a professor in Swarthmore University wrote a book on the origin of ballads, in which he showed how ballads get started, because people have dances. And as they have these folk dances, they begin to sing something. And somebody will make up a line, somebody else will make up another line, and they add to it. And thus, ballads rise out of the life of the people. I think he got this idea from some German scholars. A number of them had written along similar lines. But his book was one of the most widely read on the subject. And today, I don't think you'd find 1% of scholars in the literary field who would believe that any ballad was ever written in any such way. They would all say, to write a work of art, you have to have an individual writer of ability to write. That such a thing as coming out of the people in this way, that just does not exist. That is the attitude of the whole world of literary studies today. But for 150 years nearly, this method was very, very strongly held in the literary field. There's a book recently called The Business of Criticism by Helen Gardner, a professor in Oxford University and one of the delegates of the Oxford University Press. It's a book with three lectures in it, in one of which she quotes from a theological writer of about 1930, saying that the principle activity of criticism is to divide a book into its sources and find out who are the authors of the different sources. She points out that today practically no literary critic is even interested in such a thing. She said they are not even interested in places where you can prove sources. There's just no interest in sources today. But where you can't absolutely prove it, the tendency is to say there's just nothing to it. while in case after case of books which were considered to be written in this divided way, even 50 years ago, today there have been prominent scholars who have written books establishing their unity very, very strong. Do not say that everybody agrees that Homer is one work, because there are a group of scholars who are very strong in their insistence that it is not, they're not even sure there is a Homer. But they probably are not over 30% of the scholars in this line. 60 or 70% of them are very strong in saying there is. It is the work of one writer, whether we call him Homer or what we call him. But the interesting thing is that the people who divide Homer today have reduced the extent of division so much, or rather to make it so little, that they can't be compared to the former views of Homer. While those who hold there was one great writer recognize that there's a possibility of interpolation, the changes having come in, and so the two views actually aren't very far apart. But the two groups of scholars are bitterly opposed to each other to this day. And Homer and the Bible are about the only place where you find any of this, and very little in Homer as you, comparatively at present. Now, during that century, this literary movement was a movement of considerable importance among literary scholars. It does not affect theologians to any great extent during that century. It did not affect the rank and file of people to any great extent during this first half century, which we're looking at. It was during the second half that it began to reach out among the people, and it did that largely because of its being united with another movement of quite a different type. Well, this literary criticism then meant that by, say, 1830, there were scholars who denied that Moses wrote very much of the Pentateuch. There were scholars who started in dividing Isaiah into two parts. But the thing of this Time article, one silly thing about it is that it presents it as if today there were scholars who believed that Isaiah 1 to 39 is one book and 40 to 66 another, and I don't imagine there's any scholar standing who holds such a view today. That is, once this view was presented, of course that would be a fairly simple thing to think of as happening, that Isaiah wrote a book, and then that somebody, 100 years later, wrote a book rather similar to Isaiah, but in a different situation, and it got written on the same roll. And it could very easily be confused then. And the name Isaiah does not occur in the last 27 chapters. A very simple view to think of how it might have occurred. But before very long, those who held the view began to point to sections in 1 to 39 that had all the same earmarks in them that they found in sections from 40 to 66. And so 1 to 39 was soon divided up into many sections. And then there were those who argued very strongly that 39 to 66 were not by Isaiah, because they reflect the background of the exile, a much later period, reflected very strongly. The background is Babylonian rather than Palestinian. But others argued very strongly for the unity of the book, saying no, in between 40 and 66, there are many passages strongly reflecting a Palestinian background. And then they saw that the places that seemed to reflect a Babylonian background came mostly between 40 and 55. And the places that seemed to reflect a Palestinian background came mostly from 56 to 66. So they took the next step and said there are three Isaiahs. And you will find very few scholars today who would say there are two Isaiahs. But three main ones is held by most critical scholars today. The first 1 to 39, the second 40 to 55, and the last, third one 56 to 66. That isn't exactly at the chapter break that the division comes there. But all those who hold this view divide 1 to 39 up into many sections, and most of them divide the latter parts also into many sections. So among critical scholars today, I doubt if you'd find more than two or three of them who would hold that there were less than 40 different writers in taking all the different parts of Isaiah together. And this sort of thing presupposes an omniscience about ancient writing and habits and so on, which in all other fields is recognized as simply being not possible, and it is just not done in other fields. But this movement of literary criticism was confined to probably not more than 0.5% of the population ever heard of it during those years. It was a small class of people who were specializing in this one. But among them, some took very, very radical views regarding different parts of the Old and the New Testament. It was another influence coming in the next half century that made it begin to take a hold and to reach out widely. Now, want to move, we've been talking about Germany and England and France here. I want to look specifically at character of the Victorian Age. I'll call that E, the Victorian Age. In England, the Victorian Age in England. In England, the people as a whole were greatly affected by the evangelical revival of the 18th century. And in the 19th century, it took about 30 years before it got to the royal family. George I and George II were pretty low. This was next century. It was the end of George III's reign. George IV and William IV were pretty low type of men on the whole. And by the time that William IV finished his reign, the English people were pretty near ready to do away with monarchy altogether. And then in 1837, Victoria, the young girl, 18 years of age, became queen. And she brought into the royalty in England a far higher ethical standard than had been characteristic of her predecessors at all. And this is representative of the change that had been going through British society until from about the time Victoria became queen. During these, she continued, she lived till 1901. And during this period, there was a standard of ethics, a standard of morality in England, at least as accepted, as believed in. There was a standard which is simply difficult to imagine today. Now this, then we will look at the rise of Darwinism and at how it eventually disrupted and destroyed this standard. But at this point, I'm going to say a word about the condition as it was there, and a quote from Gertrude Himmelfarb's book, Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution. It's the best one volume on the subject from a historical viewpoint that I've ever seen. It appeared about 10 years ago. It is very full in its treatment of the rise of Darwinism and matters related to it. And it brings out the fact that in the period when Darwinism was raised up, the people of standing were agreed on ethical standards, though they might consider, many of them, that the church was a nuisance and that theological ideas were, all of them, without foundation. Thus, Darwin said the subject of God was beyond the scope of man's intellect, but he said moral obligation is clear. Man can do his duty. This was the attitude toward duty in those days among those who were giving up belief in the religious foundation upon which these ideas were based. Leslie Stevens said toward the end of the century, he said, I now believe in nothing, but do not the less believe in morality. And Frederick Harrison, they call the arch agnostic and high priest of English positivism, believed in no religious views whatever, believed in what we can see, what you can touch, what you can handle, what science proves, what they call the positivist view. Frederick Harrison, the great leader of this in England. But his son asked him one day, Himmelfarb tells us here, his son asked him one day, what is a man to do who falls in love but can't marry? What's he to do? Well, Harrison, who'd given up all religious belief, said, do what every gentleman does in such circumstances. Do what your religion teaches you. Do what morality prescribes as right. And when his son persisted in wanting to know why love was proper only in marriage, Harrison could barely contain himself. He says, a loose man is a foul man. He's antisocial. He's a beast. He finally put an end to the matter. It's not a subject that decent men discuss. I believe it was Renan, the great French skeptic of the early part of the century, who said, I deliberately imposed upon myself the morals of a Protestant clergyman. A man should never take two liberties with popular prejudices at the same time. The free thinker should be very particular as to his morals. Well, we have this attitude, and we have, in a way, a clash that comes in the latter part of the century between a large number of people who felt the church is established, the church is right, we must stand by it, and what it teaches is doubtless true, we must defend it, even if we don't understand it. And a group who had given up belief in the church, but who held strongly to these principles of morality and of truth, which they had derived from it. And the fact that some, in trying to defend certain doctrines, didn't show quite as much zeal for truth as some others seemed to, was one thing that, in the way circumstances worked, helped in getting the evolutionary situation well established in England, and eventually undermined this morality, undermined these ethics, and undermined the whole religious basis of it, until you get the result that from having in England, where the churches 100 years ago were just jammed with people, and everybody was attentive and active in church life nearly, today the churches have a tiny handful of people in, and there are other things that enter into it, but this is the big force that was operated in it. So, we mentioned E here, the character of the Victorian age in England. Now we'll call F the rise of Darwinism. The rise of Darwinism. And it would be good under that to say a little about first evolution before Darwin. It is a very common and utterly erroneous idea that Darwin originated evolution. It's completely false. Some of the old Greek writers wrote works that are recognized as definitely evolutionary presentations. Actually, there are only two possible interpretations of the universe. Either God made it, or it developed by purely natural circumstances. It's one or the other. There's no third alternative. And certain Greek writers who had lost faith in their beliefs in the sort of deities they were teaching about said, well, this whole business of deities is foolishness. How did the world come into existence? And so many books on evolution talk about the Greek precursors of it. But when you get nearer, you find that Darwin's own grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, wrote a long poem presenting a very fully worked out theory of evolution. And about the time of his grandfather, there was a man in France named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, L-A-M-A-R-C-K. And Lamarck wrote a number of books in which he presented very extensive theories of evolution. Darwin had a great dislike of Lamarck, and always speaks of him very slightingly. But many present-day scholars think that Darwin was probably indebted to Lamarck much more than he recognized. But such theories were confined to a very few people. Most scientists did not believe in them at all. A few men wrote upon these theories. What Darwin did was to win wide interest for the idea of evolution and to win wide acceptance for it. not by advancing a theory of evolution so much as by advancing an explanation of how he thought evolution might have occurred. But as Jacques Barzun of Columbia University points out, Darwin uses the term my theory in such a way that you often can't be sure whether he means evolution or whether he means his theory of how evolution occurred. But actually, evolution is no new thing with Darwin. Now, there is a great botanist we should mention who is important for the harmful influence that he had in this connection, named Linnaeus, L-I-N-N-A-E-U-S. But I see we don't have time to discuss him today.